Baruchim Abayim, ladies. We're studying Parashat Shelach Lecha. Parashat Shelach Lecha, of course, is the tragic story of Moshe Rabbeinu sending the spies, the Meragelim, to Israel, and them coming back with a bad report. The Jewish people accepting the bad report, crying because of it. God getting angry, telling the people, I told you the land is good. And now you're crying that you can't overcome the enemies, and now you're crying that it's not good. Because of that, you're not going into Israel, and you're all going to die in the Midbar. And for the subsequent 40 years that they were in the desert, every year about 15,000 Jews died on Tisha B'Av, happens to be. The night that the spies came back was Tisha B'Av, a day that was destined for history to be a bad luck evening. It was the night that the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. It was the night that the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. And even in modern times, it was the night that World War I began. Mm-hmm. So you see, it was the night that the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492. So the date on the calendar, Tisha B'Av, is earmarked for tragedy throughout history. And that night, that's when it began. It was that night when the spies came back and the Jewish people accepted their claims. And God said, that's it, you're out, you're not getting the land. It brought a massive tragedy to the people. But the rabbis have a question right at the onset, the beginning of the parashah. What is the connection between what we're going to learn this week about the spies speaking about Israel to what we just learned at the end of last week's parashah about Miriam speaking about her brother Moshe? You see, it's a fair question because the Torah, when it places things next to each other, even though they're totally different episodes, when the Torah decides to put different stories next to each other, we have a right to ask, why did God design and construct the Torah as such, putting this story next to this story, in front of that story, behind the other story? Everything has a purpose. You see, when you read the New York Times, you can't ask that question. You can't ask, you know, why they put the article about New York City over the article about Oregon. There's no reason, because that's the way it fit on the page. There's no chokmah, there's no depth to it. That's the way they configure the page. When you read a secular book, you can't ask why this chapter came before this and why this before that. That's the way the author decided to do it. But the Torah has brilliance not only in the essence of the story, but the placement of the story teaches us lessons. That's how deep the book is. So they ask, what's the connection between what we just read about Miriam talking about her brother and this week's parashah, the spies speaking about the land of Israel? And the Hachamim say something that sounds simple, but it's not. They say because the spies, they just saw what happened to Miriam after she spoke Lashon Hara about her brother. You just saw what happened. She got leprosy for 7 days. A terrible thing happened. And now right after that you go along and speak Lashon Hara about Israel? You didn't learn the lesson. It's not like you had an excuse. I didn't know. You know, how are we supposed to know you can't talk Lashon Hara? You just read it. Miriam just spoke Lashon Hara about Moshe. Look what happened to her. Look what happened. Now you come along right after that and you do it. So it aggravated the sin. It makes the sin that much worse. It's like you just saw. But all the rabbis are bothered. Then what are you talking about? There's no connection between what Miriam did to what the spies did. What lesson should they have learned? Miriam spoke about a person, a human being. They spoke about a land. What's the connection? A land is an inanimate object. A land doesn't have feelings. The reason why you can't speak about people is because people are sensitive. People take things to heart. People have emotions. You don't want to slight them. Therefore, you can't talk about people. That's the whole sin of Lashon Hara. Because people get offended. But what does that have to do with talking about a piece of land where the earth gets offended? You talk about the land, where the land gets upset, the land's going to cry. What should they have learned from Miriam that they could have applied to themselves? So Rav Shimon Schwab says something brilliant. He says, let's analyze, let's restudy that story of Miriam's Lashon Hara. Was Moshe offended? No. Was Moshe sensitive to what was said about him? No. Did Moshe care? No. And the proof of the pudding is, in the middle of that whole story of Halashon Hara, the Torah writes, Va'ish Moshe Anav, as we discussed last week. In the middle of that story, it tells us how humble Moshe was. And we can explain, well, the reason why the Torah decides to tell us about his humility at that point is to show us it didn't bother him. He was humble. Moshe was like an inanimate object. When you talked about Moshe, it was like talking about a rock. So then what was the claim then? If Moshe wasn't offended by the Lashon Hara, so why did Miriam get punished then? He wasn't offended. The explanation is, even though he wasn't offended, but Moshe is something holy. He's a piece of holiness. He's something that's kadosh. He's something that is special and admirable in the eyes of God. Something that has unique holiness, even if the man is not offended, but the mere fact that he has kedusha and God deems him special, you can't speak about him. The spy should have learned from that. If you can't speak about Moshe, a holy structure, a holy being, nothing to do with offended, not offended. You can't speak about things of holiness. So the land also. The land is something of kedusha. The land is not offended, doesn't matter. The fact that God told Miriam, what are you speaking about my servant? God told the spy the same thing. What are you speaking about my land? It's the same thing. But the land doesn't care, but you should know better. Because you just learned in last week's parashah that Moshe also didn't care. But the point is, you don't speak about things that are special to God. You don't speak to things that God deems important. Moshe is important. We don't care if he doesn't care about it. God cares about it. God chose the land of Israel. God said it's special. So you're speaking about the land, it's an offense to God himself. And that's the claim of the spies, that they didn't learn the lesson. Torah tells us, in the story of the 12 spies, that Moshe Rabbeinu made a name change on one of the spies. I don't know if many people realize that. Yehoshua ben Nun. Yehoshua, the great conqueror of Israel, the successor of Moshe Rabbeinu, his name was not always Yehoshua. Actually, the Torah tells us his name originally was Hoshea. His name started with the letter He, Hoshea. And then Moshe in this week's parasha adds the letter Yud. He changed his name from Hoshea to Yehoshua. And the rabbis ask, what's with the name change? He made Shinui Hashem. When Yehoshua wasn't sick, he didn't have to change his name. What's the purpose? So Rashi answers this question. The Yud stands for the name of God. As if to say Moshe was praying for his student Yehoshua. Ya Yoshiacha me'atzat meragelim. Moshe saw that the spies might come back with a bad report. He saw the attitude that they left with was a little negative. He saw that there was a chance of disaster. And he didn't want his student Yehoshua to get caught up in this mess of the spies. So he prayed for him. He made a name change. He added the letter Yud as if he put God's letter in his name, Yehoshua, to say, please, God should save you from this potential disaster. The question then is, why is he only praying for Yehoshua? Simply because it's a student. A rabbi must be very careful, specifically, of the behavior of his students. Because the behavior of the rabbi's students reflects the rabbi himself. And therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu, in order to protect his own reputation in the eyes of the people, if Yehoshua comes back and is like everybody else, Say, look at Yoshua, was he different than anybody? His rabbi's Moshe, big deal, he also made the same avon. So Moshe has to protect the sanctity of what he is, of the rabbinate. But I saw a wonderful explanation that says, you know why Moshe had to bless him? Targum explains, because Moshe saw that Yehoshua was very, very humble. And that's why he needed a little encouragement. Very humble. Beautiful. Very humble is a good thing. Very humble is not a bad thing. And we wouldn't expect anything less from Yehoshua, because he was a good student. Moshe Rabbeinu's quality was humility. Obviously Yehoshua is going to emulate his rabbi. So he was also very humble. So the rabbis say, when Moshe saw that Yehoshua was overly humble, he blessed him, please don't fall. What does it mean? Why would humility cause him to fall? And the explanation can be as follows. The Gemara tells us a story in Gittin. Listen to a story. Gemara says there was a fellow called Bar Kamsa. He was a rotten man. He was Jewish, but he was an anti-Semite. He hated the Jewish people with a passion. And he wanted to create animosity between the Caesar and the Jewish people. So he went to the Caesar and he said, listen, the Jewish people have rebelled against you. The Caesar says, what are you talking about? I'm on good terms with the Jewish people. I have no problems. Yeah, they won't even bring you sacrifices anymore. So what are you talking? I always send sacrifices to the Beit HaMikdash. They always accept it. The Jewish law says we accept sacrifices from the Gentiles in order to keep peace. Why wouldn't they accept? Bar Kamsa says, watch, give me an animal. I bet you they don't accept it. So the king gave him an animal. On the way there, Kamsa went and wounded the animal. He put a blemish. Yes. Now they bring it to the Beit HaMikdash. They tell the Kohanim over there, okay, this is from the Caesar. The Kohanim look at it, they say, Dachilak, there's a wound over here, what are we going to do? They said, on one hand, if we don't bring it, the Caesar's going to go crazy. On the other hand, there's a wound. You know what, let's go to the rabbi. They went to a rabbi called Rav Zechariah ben Avkulas. Listen to a story. Hard to imagine. They go to Rav Zechariah. Chacham, should we bring the korban? He says, no, you can't bring the korban. How could you bring the korban? There's a blemish on it. I can't take responsibility for such a thing. You know, people are going to think that you're allowed to bring blemished animals on the mizbeah. But Chacham, the Caesar's going to go crazy. Halakha, I can't. There's a wound. So, okay, Rabbi, let us kill Bar Kamsa. Let's kill the guy so he can't go back to the Caesar and report that we didn't bring the animal. Good idea. Zechariah comes along and says, I don't know. You can't kill a guy because it is. They're going to think now that if you put a blemish in an animal, you get killed because of it. I can't take the responsibility. You can't kill him. Sure enough, they didn't bring the sacrifice. Bar Kamsa went back to the Caesar, told the king, and he set the wheels in motion. And eventually the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed as a result of it. Could you believe such a story? And who does the Gemara blame it on? The Gemara says, no. The humility of the rabbi, the humility of Rav Zechariah ben Avkulas destroyed our temple. What do you mean the humility of the rabbi? What they meant to say was, yes, Rav Zechariah was a big tzaddik. He was very humble. But he was overly humble. He was too humble. In this case, he said he should have made a stand. He should have got up and said, Rabotai, this is an exception. There's circumstances over here. I know it never happened, such a thing. We never brought a sacrifice with a wound. We never killed a guy. But this is different. He should have exercised his leadership at that moment and said, we have to do this because it's the right thing. But the Zechariah was very humble, too humble. I don't know, they're going to say, maybe, should we, shouldn't we? So they said this was no time for humility, Rav Zechariah. You should have passed a decree, a royal order from the rabbinate in order to make a takana. And you used humility, this type of humility destroyed the temple. Yehoshua had the same humility. He was very humble. Moshe was scared that what's going to happen? All the spies are going to come back with a bad report. Yeshua, in humility, might say, what am I? All these spies are great rabbis. Ten rabbis are saying the land stinks. Well, I'm going to come along and argue. I'm going to come along and say, no, it's good. I'm going to buck 10 rabbis. I'm going to go against the majority. Who am I? I'm nothing. I'm zero. I don't have the ability to fight against 10 hachamim. If he was alone, he can have a positive opinion. But once you're going to have already such influence of powerful and influential men, Moshe says, his humility in this case will work against him. He didn't want Yeshua in his timidness, in his humble manner, to buckle to the opinion. So therefore he had to fortify him before he left. He said, God should save you from the idea of the Meragelim. That change of name gave Yeshua confidence to control his humility. So when the spy says the land stinks, Yeshua got up and says, they don't know what they're talking about. The land is good. Is that Yeshua? This is the most humble of men. All of a sudden now he's protesting? Where does that come from? That comes from the genius of Moshe Rabbeinu that saw a good trait. But even good traits have to be controlled. Because if you let a good trait run wild, it can turn out to be a bad trait. So even the good midav anava has to be harnessed. It has to be controlled to know when to use it and to know when not to use it. I saw a thought on this name change that I think is brilliant to show you how deep our Torah is again. It can be studied on so many levels. And just when you think you understand the concept, you're able to derive from every sentence thousands of applications. Let me tell you a story that happened. There was a synagogue that they had the front row. Front row obviously being the best seats, and all the hashuv people that want to sit in the front row paid some money to sit right at the front. And then years later, the committee had decided that there's more seats needed to be added to the synagogue. So they put a row in front of the front row. So, oh, and now all the people in the original front row, they said, what are you talking about? You can't do that. We bought front row seats. Now we're in the second row. No, it's fair. They went to Betin. They're screaming. No, hey, oh, you're doing something asur. So they went to Betin. They brought it to the great Hachamim at the time. And what happened? The Hachamim said, keep everybody where they are. They have no claim. Leave them in the original receipts that they were. They can't move up. The Hacham, where do you get this from? He said, I'll tell you where I get it from. Listen to brilliance. Yeshua's name originally was Hosea. God or Moshe took a yud and added it. The Gemara asks, where did he get this yud from? What, Moshe Rabbeinu has letters in his pocket? He can just come along and start adding names to the Torah? All the letters in this book over here are accounted for. There's not extra letters, not extra syllable. Where does Moshe Rabbeinu, but this is not Wheel of Fortune over here, he's buying letters. Where did he get the extra yud from? How does it work over here? So the Mefarshim explain that there was an extra yud floating around. Because if you remember, Sarah Imenu, her original name was Sarai. Sarai ends with a yud. So God, when he changed the name to Sarai, put a he. So there was an extra yud now in the box. So Moshe took the extra yud in the box. He said, okay, the yud's there. As a matter of fact, the Gemara goes even further. When God took the Yud out of Sarai's name, the Yud started complaining. The Yud said, what kind of business over here? I was in the letter of a tzedeket. I was in the name of Sarai. Now you took me, you put me in Geniza, what kind of thing? I don't want to, it's not fair. So God said, don't worry. I'm going to pay you back. Not only am I going to put you in a tzaddik, But in Sarai's name, you were at the end of her name. I'm going to put you in the beginning of the name. So I said, okay, you put me in the beginning. He said, no, I don't have any claims. So God puts the Yud in the beginning. Oh, so comes the rabbi and says, hold it, that's not fair. You put the Yud in the beginning, now the letter He of Hosea, you put the letter He second now. Originally the He, Hosea, was first. It was sitting in the front row, Hosea ben Nun, the He. Now you come and put a Yud in front of it? The He can come to God and say, you sketched me, I was in the front row, now you put the Yud in front of me, now I'm second. But you see that the letter He had no claims. The Gemara says the letter He was... because I didn't move you, I just put somebody in front of you. You stayed where you are. You're sitting in the same spot, the seat that you bought, nothing changed. No. It's just that somebody else is sitting in front of you. Your spot is the same. The head didn't move, somebody was put in front. Therefore, the people in the front row have no claim. Sit where you want. Look at this. From a name change of Moshe to Hosea ben Nun to Yoshua, already you're able to solve dilemmas in shul politics, in halakha, to show you the brilliance of such a sefer. But I told you this chiddush for a more important reason. If God saw in His infinite wisdom that the Yud that's going to be added to the name of Yoshua must come from Sarai Imenu, there has to be a connection. I mean, God managed it as such that there'll be an extra letter, it'll go to... but there must be a connection. Why did the letter have to come from Sarai Imenu? And the explanation is according to what we said. The problem with Yehoshua was he was overly humble and Moshe was scared that he might buckle to the pressure of the other spies in humility. But there was one personality in the Torah that was very opinionated and didn't buckle, and that was Sarai Imenu. If you remember, Sarai Imenu once told her husband, throw Yishmael out of here. And Abraham said, what are you talking about? Throw Yishmael out, Chazit. Yishmael's my son. What are you talking, throw him out? We don't throw out kids. All my life I'm bringing people back to religion. Now you're telling me to throw out my own son? Sarai says, you don't know what you're talking about, Abraham. You're making a mistake. I'm right. Where do you get such courage? Gadol Ador, Abraham Abinu, the greatest man that lived. And his wife now is challenging him, not on a recipe, challenging him on a halakha, challenging him on chinuch. Who knows more about bringing people back to religion? Abraham wrote the book. Abraham invented it. What are you going to tell Abraham now to run his business? That he should throw out his son? Abraham says, Sarai, you're wrong. God comes down and says, Abraham, you're wrong. Listen to Sarai. Sarai knows what she's talking about. Sarah had a tremendous amount of courage. She didn't care if Abraham is saying, I don't care, Abraham, I'm telling you, he's out. Yehoshua needed that strength that Sarah Imenu had. So therefore, specifically the letter Yud from Sarah was added to Yehoshua to give Yehoshua that courage, that even though the 10 people are going to say it's bad, he'll be able to say it's good. That's what it means on the name change. We'll go a little further. The spies, they do ask a question, interestingly enough. Why didn't Moshe pray for the other spy that came out with a positive conclusion? There were two spies that were good, Yehoshua and Caleb. Caleb also came back, things are okay. Where did Caleb get his strength from? It says on the way into Israel, he stopped off at Hebron. In Hebron, he visited the Me'arat HaMachpelah, the tomb of the forefathers, and he prayed over there, please Hashem, save me from these guys. So everybody had their fortification. Moshe handled Yehoshua, Caleb handled himself by the Me'arat HaMachpelah. You see, incidentally, ladies, how powerful and how strong a bad influence is. You could be Yehoshua ben Nun, the ultimate leader. You could be Caleb ben Yefuneh, tzaddik in his time. But without the proper preparations of prayer or visiting the Avot, they would have succumbed also to the peer pressure of the other 10 tribes, the 10 leaders. You see what it means, peer pressure. You could be the greatest Sadiq, you could be on the highest level, but when you're in a bad group, the group is able to influence you. What a lesson this is as we enter the summer season. The summer season, the peer pressure is much stronger than it is all year round. Only because all year round, people in general are a little more conservative in their behavior. The weather's cold, therefore the people are more to themselves, they don't go out as often, the dress is obviously more modest and reserved. However, when the summer comes, it's a certain attitude, specifically in our country, of laxity, of freedom, and so on. People are a little more out, it's a little more lightheaded. Even the good people, even the serious people, have no choice but to be affected. There's no question. If the whole world is in such an attitude, it is almost impossible to keep the proper attitude and the proper seriousness and the proper focus. This is a lesson that you learn. If Caleb and Yehoshua, the greatest people, without preparation, would not have been able to withstand the peer pressure of those 10 people, or the more so ourselves before we enter this season, or as we enter this season, without proper preparation, whether it's mental preparation, spiritual preparation, prayer, in order to protect us and our children from society, we're doomed. We don't stand a shot. If they, who are much greater than us, had problems withstanding the pressure, what can we say about ourselves that we don't have that inner fortitude that Yehoshua and Caleb had? But one rabbi said, very nice. He said, how come Moshe didn't pray for Caleb? Okay, he wants to take care of his student, Yehoshua, it's one of his own. But pray for Caleb also if he saw Caleb had potential. So they say he didn't have to pray for Caleb. You know why? Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says, because Caleb was married to a great lady. Caleb was married to none other than Miriam. Miriam and Nebi'ah, Moshe's sister. Moshe knew who Miriam was. Moshe said, with a wife like Miriam, I have no doubt Caleb has all the strength in the world. He has nothing to worry about. Therefore, I don't have to worry about him. Therefore, Moshe prayed for Yehoshua, who was less confident, but for Caleb, he trusted more Miriam than Caleb himself. And sure enough, Caleb came back with the proper report. The interesting part of this is, it says they came back and they gave a whole story. Where did they come back? They said like this. They said, "Eretz zavat halav udvashi." We say, we're not going to lie to you. It's a beautiful land. It's a land of flowing milk and honey. Beracha. Veze pirya. They showed them the fruits. The Gemara discusses how big the grapes were. How many people it took. The Gemara Sota has different arguments. 8 people, 10 people. How many people it took to carry a cluster of grapes? They carried it on sticks. They had to bring it. It was like they were carrying they were like watermelons, each grape. And now imagine a watermelon the size of on a cluster. So you have 30 of them on a cluster. Show how heavy it was. Look at the fruit. What a blessing. What a beracha. And then they come along and say, Ephes, but ki aza ama yoshev ba'aris. But you also have to know that there's giants living in this land. They're very strong. They live in fortified cities. We saw Amalek. They gave the good side, and then they gave the famous, however, there's also this. And that was the claim against them. So all the rabbis ask, what's the claim? They're reporting what they saw. What, they didn't see giants? They saw giants. What, they didn't see fortified cities? They saw fortified cities. They saw Amalek. It's not like they came back and made up stories. It's not like they came back and said, you don't know what's going to happen. We saw this. And they fabricated a whole story. They told it like it was. So where's the claim here? I don't see any Lashon Hara over here. So the Ramban writes that you're right. The claim here was one word. And that one word turned an innocent statement into the worst Lashon Hara. The word Ephes. Efes can be explained as we said. However, meaning we saw good, we saw beracha, flowing milk and honey, However, we also saw this. But in Hebrew, the more common word used for however is aval. Efes is very rarely used. But the word efes has another meaning also. Efes means zero. Efes, zero. What they were saying with this word efes, they weren't merely reporting what they saw. They were giving an opinion. They came along and said, yeah, we saw blessing. We saw Zavat Halav Udvash. We saw unbelievable. But all that is efes. It's worthless because we saw the other thing. Who asked you for your opinion? We just came back. Give us the report. We'll make the opinion. The Miragelim's mistake was they thought that their role as messengers was, as spies, was to decide whether we should go or not. But we didn't ask you to go. We didn't ask you that. We're going. That was... You were just going to come back and tell us, should we go from the north? Should we go from the south? Where's easier? Where's not? You were going for strategy. But they came back along and they took their mission. They made a mistake here. They came along and said, it's a great land. But you know what? Ephes, worthless because this... Oh, worthless? What worthless? Because of that one word, Ephes. If they would have used the word aval, you're okay. You're reporting facts. Ephes comes along and says, pay no attention to what we just said about the goodness. Because that's going to mean nothing compared. The bad outweighs the good. Comes the Stipler rabbi and says the following. He says, one of the things they saw was massive funerals. It says wherever they went, the whole tour that they took was 40 days. Wherever they went, they saw throngs of people burying their dead. Massive funerals. So when they came back and they reported that, they said, you know, we saw people dying. Eres ochelet yosheveha. It's a land that eats its inhabitants. There must be something in the air. There must be something in the water. Shema Yisrael, every day we saw funerals, people dying. What kind of land is this? So the Stipler says again, did they see it or did not they see it? If they saw it, so what do you want from them? What did they make? They didn't see funerals, they saw funerals. So what's the claim? They're only reporting to Moshe and the people what happened. And if they indeed saw funerals all day long, isn't that something to be concerned about? Maybe the water is poisoned. Maybe there's something in the air. So what do you have a claim against them? It's cautious. They're saying something that have to warn the people. So the Stipler says like this. Two people could see the same thing. They could witness the same event. But the way they interpret it, one can interpret it positively and one can interpret it negatively. It all depends on his starting point of objectivity when he's looking at what he's looking at. If a person's objective, if he's clear, if he has no prejudices, if he's looking at it with an honest eye, he'll come up with the proper conclusion. But once a person has a prejudice and he has already a leaning towards one way and he has a tendency to, then already he could take the same item and spin it and see something bad. The problem, he says, with the spies was when they came into Israel, they didn't have an objective eye from the get-go. Therefore, everything they saw, they spinned it in the negative way. Why? How come they weren't objective? So the Zohar says, isn't there a Zohar? That deep down, in the recesses of these spies' hearts, there was something that was working against them. They saw a prophecy. They had Ruach HaKodesh, these men. Look what type of men you're talking. These were not gangsters, God forbid. These men were righteous. They were Sadiqim, leaders of the tribes. They had divine inspiration. But the Zohar says, you know what they saw? That when the Jews enter Israel, they are going to be demoted from their positions. They're going to have elections again, and new presidents are going to be elected. That already tainted their vision. They had a reason not to want to go to Israel now. If we go to Israel, we lose our kavod. Now, I don't think, or I say better, I know that was not obvious to anybody, including the spies themselves. You understand many times when they tell you subconsciously there was something working, when they go to psychology, they tell you because 30 years ago somebody told you something, now it came out. Oh, Hadush, I didn't know that. They're able to figure out this was the Torah in its brilliant psychology telling you, if you'd ask the spies even, oh, you did this because you want to be president? No, Hasb Shalom, what are you talking about? I don't want a president. I wasn't even thinking about that. But the Zohar knows what was pushing them. It was kavod. Although it wasn't obvious, it wasn't on the surface, you needed the Zohar with its microscope, with its magnifying glass, to look deep, deep down into their psyche to find out what was causing them to misinterpret all these things. Oh, the Zohar comes up with the... We found it! Bidikat Hametz, we found the Hametz over here. What was it? Kavod. They didn't want to lose their position. They didn't want to lose their job. Therefore, they came back with a terrible report. But comes the stipend and says, okay, could you interpret me funerals in a positive way? Would you? Okay, so they were jaundiced in their vision. They were biased. What should they sort of said? She be genin. We saw people dying. There was funerals every day. The funeral houses are packed. It's a good industry. We'll open up funeral parlors. What did you want them to say? God, it's a terrible. What could they say? Oh, brilliant lady, excellent. You're 100% right. You answered it. Next week you can give the class instead of me. I'll explain it to what she said. I'll explain it. The answer is beautiful. The answer is like this. Do you remember when Yehoshua, we read in the Haftarah, when Yehoshua ben Nun, when he entered Israel, he also sent spies. He didn't send 12 spies. He sent 2 spies. And do you know that the day that they penetrated into the land, they got caught? Already the people were on them already. They had to hide in somebody's house. They almost got killed. Which means you understand the land of Canaan, they were very wary of spies. They had intelligence all over the place. They were very careful. Ask yourself a question. This was 12 men for 40 days. How did they get picked up? None of the CIA, FBI, nobody caught them. Nobody saw them. Why? They're walking around looking and searching. They're Jews. Nobody saw one of them. And the explanation, look at God's kindness. He had them so involved in funerals. For those 40 days, people were dying. What happened? Everybody's busy going to funerals, avelut, crying. So these guys are running around, taking reports, doing, where's everybody? They're disoriented. Their mind is off everything. God threw off the whole country to keep them busy so these spies could do their job. So they should have came back and said, look how God was good to us. And you know how they should have known that? The stipler says they should have known it. You know why? Because if indeed they were right that people dying every day, it's a land that kills its inhabitants, the funerals wouldn't have been so big. Because what happens, if that's the normal thing where there's a funeral every single day, after a while, finished, they're going to be small funerals. I think every day, everybody, the whole country could take off to go to funerals. You'd have the family, a couple of people, and Kalasna. If you're seeing tremendous funerals where everybody's going to, that must be this is a novelty. Must be this doesn't happen too often. If they're making such a big deal out of it, must be that just began. They should have see the way to interpret. They could have interpreted the most said the most morbid events, they could have said, unbelievable, Yishtabach Shem Olah, look how God is good to us, look what God did for us, He shielded us for 40 days, we're going to kill these guys, God's with us. But because of that bias, because of that kavod, because they had their ego in the way, because they were blinded by power, the power did not let them make the right decision. Now, of course, we can learn great lessons from this. Number one, that our perception of things sometimes is not going to be what it really is. The Gemara tells a story of a rabbi called Rav Elish. Rav Elish was in jail. He was imprisoned. And as he's in jail with somebody else next to him, a bird came in and flew into the jail and chirped something into the rabbi's ear. The bird chirped and told the rabbi, Elish, run away, escape. The rabbi understood the language of the birds. There is a language that they speak. So he understood what the chirping meant. But he went to the guy sitting next to him and says, did you hear that? He says, yeah. He says, tell me what he said. He says, Elish, escape. Elish, escape. So Rav Akiva Ege asked the question. What did he have to ask him for? You speak bird language. What, you needed a confirmation? You needed a translator? You understood what it said? What did you have to get the second opinion over here? So Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz answers brilliantly. He says, you know why he had to ask for a second opinion? Because he wanted to hear that from the bird. Therefore, he wasn't sure that that's what the bird really said. Of course he wants to hear the bird tell him, escape, you're going to be okay. So therefore, he's I'm not objective here. Did I really hear that? Or maybe I'm just thinking what I want to hear. So he turned to the guy next to him. Did he say I should escape? Oh yeah, he said it. He realized that since he wasn't objective, he might not be able to perceive what just happened. So he went for a second opinion. In life, many times, we're not able to perceive situations because, in religion especially, we have a slanted view because we once saw somebody who's religious act the wrong way, and therefore our opinion is already ruined, it's spoiled. Therefore, we could never look at a religious thing in the proper light. We saw this mitzvah done the wrong way, and it turned us off. Now, any time we're turned to that mitzvah already, we can't look at it because we have that image. But your perception is off. Go to somebody objective and say, am I seeing it the right way? No, you're wrong. This is you have a hang up. This is your issue. It's not the mitzvah, it's perfect. Do not let your own prejudices cause you to misinterpret the truths of life. But there's another lesson that may be learned from here, the issue of kavod. And we'll conclude with this. What does it mean, kavod? What does it mean, power? What does it mean, respect? A very difficult thing to overcome. There's no question about it. The Mishnah says, "Hakavod, those that seek honor, their thirst can never be quenched. Those that seek power, it's unlimited what they'll seek, what they'll earn, what they'll yearn for. Kavod motzi et adam min ha'olam." It drives a man out of the world, not only in a spiritual sense, but somebody that's obsessed with kavod, he can't live in this world. It drives him crazy. He walks into the synagogue. How come they didn't stand up for me? How come they didn't give me this aliyah? How come they didn't honor me? How come I didn't get invited? Such a person has no life. Everything he does, he's thinking, my honor was slighted, my kavod. He doesn't have serenity. He doesn't have comfort. Everything is why this and they didn't, and I expect and I deserve. Hakavod motzi et ha'adam min ha'olam. Kavod removes a person out of the world, not the next world. This world, he won't be able to live because he's consumed with it. And here you see what kavod did. Even a little tinge of it that was deep down was able to cause what it did. Ladies, just want to give you a little word of chizuk. Baruch Hashem, the past however many weeks, we came every Thursday and we studied Parashat HaShavua. It's to your credit. You gave from your time, which is really exceptional behaviors, no question. Thursday is a difficult day. The timing is not so conducive for Torah. There's errands, Echbod Shabbat, which you're all doing, and you should be applauded for your efforts that you came. This class is not about the rabbi giving a class. It's about the students, about the ladies coming in order to hear Devrei Torah on a weekly basis. Ashrechem, we're proud of you. Keep up the good work. Don't stop the momentum in the summer, Bezat Hashem. We'll continue this, of course, in this venue, in our years, God willing, right when we come back from the summer in September. And Beli Neder in Deal, if we have a chance to do this once in a while, class reunion will also make it, Bezat Hashem. Amen.